Jenny Fielding is Mrs. Sanderson now. She has a husband, two daughters, Julia and Marjorie, and three grandchildren. Every year, Julia and Marjorie send new school photographs of the grandchildren, Angus, Alice and Rose. Mrs. Sanderson arranges them on the sideboard. On the wall hangs Mr. Sanderson's school photograph. It's black and white and a metre long, the whole school in it together. One after another, Angus, Alice and Rose have asked, "Grandpa, how was it done?" Mr. Sanderson explains that once all school photographs were like that and had to be taken with a special camera. Everybody was arranged in a huge semicircle, and the camera, which was clockwork, slowly turned, panning from one end of the curve to the other. Mr. Sanderson is in the middle of the fourth row, looking very young and serious. But at either end of the second row are the Schofield triplets. Really, they were twins, Marcus and Ben, Mr. Sanderson tells them, and they were standing one each end of the row. When the camera got halfway round, Ben left his place and ran along the back of the others faster than the camera was moving and went to stand beside Marcus at the other end. They got into a terrible row when they were found out, but we all thought they were heroes. Angus, Alice and Rose look closely at Grandpa's school photograph to admire the heroic Schofield twins. Ben at one end, Ben and Marcus at the other. "Did you have a school photograph, Granny?" Rose asks. "I did once," Mrs. Sanderson says, "but I must have lost it." She hates lying, but if she told the truth about her school photograph, no one would believe her. At the back of her dressing table drawer is Jenny Fielding's school photograph, still rolled into a cylinder as it was on the day she first brought it home 40 years ago. She's never shown it to anyone since. Jenny was 13 when the notice was given out in assembly that the photographer was coming. Miss Shaw, the form teacher, had a few more words of her own to add. "You will all make sure that your uniforms are clean and that your hair is tidy. There will be a rehearsal on Friday so that each girl knows where she's to stand. And wherever you stand on Friday," said Miss Shaw, fixing them with an iron gaze, "you will stand on Monday. There are always certain people who imagine that it's amusing to run from one end of the line to the other in order to appear twice. Anyone who does that will be dealt with severely. Do I make myself clear?" In the back row, Jenny's great friend, Marjorie Fletcher, turned her head slightly and muttered to Jenny, "I bet it will be one of us. I have a feeling."
Did you speak, Marjorie?"
Miss Shaw inquired. I just said I might get my hair cut," Marjorie said pleasantly, "for the photograph."
"An excellent idea," said Miss Shaw.
Marjorie's hair, like Jenny's, was wild and dark and curly. They were very alike in other ways too, and were often mistaken for each other. They were best friends. They went everywhere together, near enough. It had come as no surprise when this announcement was made in assembly. Bush Telegraph had seen to that. So it was already public knowledge that after the rehearsal on Friday morning, the lottery would take place. Friday involved a great deal of standing about in a chilly, damp wind on the lawn in front of the school. In the centre of the lawn stood a long, curved row of 80 chairs, with a row of benches behind them and a row of tables behind that. One after another, the classes stepped forward to take their places. The third year stood on the grass behind the sixth form and staff. The fourth year stood behind them on the benches, and at the back, the fifth forms teetered on the tables. Jenny and Marjorie found themselves facing each other across the grass at opposite ends of the third year. And Jenny was remembering what Marjorie had said last week. "I bet it will be one of us." Jenny was on the left, the end that the camera started from. The entrance for the lottery met at the back of the sports pavilion after lunch. Jenny from the third year, Madeline Enderby from the second year, Dawn Fuggle from the fourth, and Glenda Alcott from the fifth. all the left-hand tail-enders, except for the first year, who were considered too young, and the sixth form, who were above such things. Glenda was there before them, holding her blue felt school hat, in which lay four tightly folded pieces of paper. "Three of these are blank," Glenda said. "One carries the black spot. Whoever draws the black spot is the one that changes ends. As soon as the camera is pointing to the middle, you leave your place and run to the other end of the line. Are you prepared to risk it?" The other three nodded solemnly. "All right, then. Draw your papers," said Glenda. Jenny just stared at her folded paper, remembering what Marjorie had said. "I bet it will be one of us. I have a feeling." Marjorie had had feelings before. She had had a feeling that she would be singing the descant in Adeste Fidelis. And then Susan Beale lost her voice just before they were due to start. "I have a feeling Cranmer House won't win the acting prize this year," Marjorie had said the day before the drama competition, "although Cranmer House were a dead cert." And sure enough, on the day, Cranmer fluffed their lines and missed their cues, and the cup was awarded to Beckett House. Marjorie and Jenny were in Beckett. Marjorie's feelings always seemed to involve misfortune for someone. But you couldn't blame Marjorie for that. She hadn't given Susan laryngitis or nobbled the entire cast of Cranmer's play. "Open your papers," Glenda said. And Jenny unfolded the little wad in her hand. She hardly needed to look. She knew it would be her paper that bore the black spot. "Nobody must tell anyone else who's won, except you, Jenny," Glenda said. "You must appoint a liaison officer. If you're going to come down with something at the last moment, you must let us know so that we three can draw again." Jenny knew there was no chance of that, or Marjorie would have mentioned it. But she had to do what Glenda said, just in case. "Will you be my liaison officer?" Jenny asked Marjorie, who showed no surprise when Jenny handed her the black spot. "No need," said Marjorie. "If anything happens to you, I'll run instead. People will think it's you anyway. Actually," she added, "I have a feeling I may have to do it." "Why, am I going to drop dead before Monday?" Jenny snapped. Suddenly she felt she'd had enough of Marjorie and her feelings. On Monday morning, she made herself especially tidy, as demanded, for the photograph. Waiting in the form room for assembly, everyone preened and checked each other out, so Jenny had only just noticed Marjorie was not in the room before Miss Shaw appeared at the door and beckoned her out. "Jenny," Miss Shaw said, "I wanted a word with you before I told the others. I know Marjorie's a friend of yours." Jenny did not have feelings, not the way Marjorie did, but she knew what was coming. "Marjorie had an accident yesterday," Miss Shaw said. "She was out for a drive with some family friends, and the car door wasn't properly shut. Marjorie was thrown out into the road when they took a bend too sharply. I'm afraid she's badly hurt." At break, the news was all round the school. Glenda Alcott came to find Jenny. "You needn't run if you don't want to," Glenda said kindly. "We'll understand." "I'll be all right," Jenny said. She knew that if she had the photograph to worry about, she might not have to think of Marjorie lying in the hospital. "Listen," said Glenda, "someone told me they'd do it twice, just in case anyone does run. The first time, they don't run the film. Well, that's how they did it at my brother's school." They stood tier upon tier. Jenny looked across that great curve to the place where Marjorie ought to have been standing and did not move. Glenda had been right. After the camera had swept round, the little photographer blew his whistle, said, "All right, ladies, let's do it once more," and redirected the camera on its tripod towards Jenny's end of the line. He sounded his whistle again. Very slowly, the camera began to turn a second time. The first time, she had counted the seconds until it seemed to have reached the headmistress. When the moment came, she took a step backwards, turned, and began to run. She hadn't thought what it would be like behind the curve. The backs of the fifth year standing on their tables reared above her. A palisade of legs, a swathe of skirts, battlement of heads. The curve seemed endless. She ran faster, racing her hidden adversary. 3 yards from the end of the line, she slipped. Her foot skidded from under her and she fell flat. She scrambled to her feet, but it was too late to run on. As she rose upright, there was a surge of muted laughter and conversation. The camera had got there first. Glenda, who had seen her leave and been able to see also that she'd not arrived at the far end, jumped down from the table and hurried round to find out what had happened. "Did you fall? Bad luck." "Oh, hey, don't cry," Glenda said when she found Jenny weeping on the grass. Madeline and Dawn were not so charitable. "One of us could have run," Madeline grumbled. "Jenny has something on her mind," Glenda said, severely, and the other two became all at once very serious. Jenny's mother came to the school at the end of the afternoon to meet Jenny and take her home. Marjorie had died just after 2 o'clock, while they were having the photograph taken. Everyone at school was sympathetic until the photographs arrived. And then the storm broke, for there was Jenny, standing on the left-hand side of the picture, and there at the far end was Jenny again, looking a little dishevelled and blurred. "It isn't me," Jenny kept saying. "I never got there. I fell over." She was, as promised, severely dealt with, and everyone despised her for not admitting to what she'd done when the evidence was there in black and white. Except for 3 people. Glenda, Madeline and Dawn had all been watching the far end, and they alone knew she had never got there. Glenda borrowed a magnifying glass, and they studied that little figure at the right hand of the photograph. "It could be you," she said finally. What she didn't say, and what they were all thinking, was, "It could be Marjorie." This is why Mrs. Sanderson keeps her school photograph in a drawer instead of hanging it on the wall beside her husband's. Even now, 40 years later, she can't bring herself to explain. That was In Black and White by Jan Mark. It was abridged for radio by Peter Carey and read by Anne Rye. In Black and White was produced in Manchester by Martin Jameson.